Well, it's a delight to be with you. I've looked forward to arriving and having this time together with you. I have known some of you in past years and look forward to getting to know others of you while we're together this week. I can already tell that Monday through Wednesday is going to be far too short a time for me to enjoy being with you as much as I would like, but we'll do the best that we can with the time that we have. I've been asked to speak this morning on the subject of sexual modesty in dress. That is certainly a difficult subject for us to study, and is a very sensitive subject to try to speak on. I don't know of a more challenging topic from the standpoint of public teaching than this one, but we simply can't afford to remain silent about this issue. I'm afraid that too many of the Lord's people in our day, we're just selling our souls in order to try to fit in to the culture around us. We are, I'm afraid, captives of our culture far more than we might be willing to realize. And so we're going to address this issue this morning, and I hope it will be in a helpful way. I don't expect that everybody will agree with everything I say this morning. But I do ask that you at least give these thoughts a fair hearing. I hope that you will listen, not with resistance, but with an open mind, and think with us about what is surely a very important subject. This is an especially important subject for a couple of different reasons. For one thing, as I mentioned, we live in a culture that is so ungodly in so many ways, almost hard for us to describe it, and getting worse all of the time. The age in which we live reminds us of Isaiah's day, when it was said in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." We live in a day when moral values are being turned upside down and inside out. When it comes to the subject of sexual immorality, that is especially the case. We have, as was said in Jeremiah's day, Jeremiah 6 and verse 15, we've lost the ability to blush. That which would have been shameful even in fairly recent years is no longer considered to be shameful. Our culture reminds me very much of the days that Paul described in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 19 when he talked about those whose glory is in their shame. We're no longer ashamed of things that we should blush about, but we glory in those things. We not only do them, but we are proud that we do them, and we parade them publicly. Then that's a distressing time in which to live. Well, obviously, if that's a problem among the Lord's people, and culture always is a problem among the Lord's people because we live in this culture, we breathe the same atmosphere that our next-door neighbors do, that affects us. And we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which the problem of sexual immodesty in dress has influenced even those who want to be the Lord's people in this generation. But of special concern to me is the impact that these trends have upon our young people. When there are distressing cultural trends around us, that is a worrisome matter, and if those become congregational problems, then that is an even more worrisome matter. But if it affects our younger people, and this problem certainly does, then that would make it an issue of very great concern to all of us. I want to begin with some clarifications, try to make a couple of things clear right at the very start. And one of them is that I understand that while we're going to be talking about immodesty in dress this morning, I understand that there's more than one kind of immodesty. We could be immodest in our speech, in our behavior, as well as our dress. And if we wanted to be immodest in our dress, there'd be more than one way to do that besides sexual immodesty. We might be showy or ostentatious, immodest in that way. And those are all subjects that we might need to talk about at other times. But while those other aspects are important, sexual immodesty in dress, I believe, is the more prevalent and dangerous problem in our culture right now. And so that's what this lesson is about. But I understand that there are other kinds of immodesty that we might need to talk about on some other occasion. I also understand that immodesty is a matter not just about clothing, it's primarily a matter of the heart. It doesn't do any good to dress modestly if your heart is immodest. But by the same token, if your heart is immodest, it doesn't do any good to dress immodestly. And that's really the problem that we're going to try to talk about this morning, the disconnect that there sometimes is between what really is an honest and a pure heart that we'd like to have on the inside, but we sometimes just don't see the disconnect between our heart and the... Maybe that'll come back. Hope that it will. So I understand that this is a heart issue, but the heart overflows in our speech and our behavior and our actions, and so we need to talk about the external aspect of this. I also understand that it's not just a woman's subject. It is a fact that men can be immodest and even immodest in their clothing, as women can. But it is also a fact that on this particular subject, the scriptures more usually address it from the woman's perspective. And we'll talk about some of the reasons why that is the case, but I just want you to understand that this is not just a woman's subject. If you are a man who dresses immodestly, then you need to listen to this lesson just as much as any woman ever did. But with those clarifications, let's think about the specific subject of sexual immodesty in dress. So first of all, think about a passage in the Old Testament that talked about the problem of uncovering of our nakedness. You realize, of course, that in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were unclothed, and in their absolute innocence, there was nothing wrong with that at all. But when the law of Moses was revealed in Leviticus 18, starting in verse 6, the law said, "None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness." Well, what's going on there? Well, obviously, the expression in this context, to uncover the nakedness of somebody, is a euphemism for having sexual intercourse with that person. Don't uncover the nakedness of this person means don't have sexual intercourse with that individual. But that's an interesting way of putting that, isn't it? Not to uncover nakedness implies that, at least outside the Garden of Eden, the norm is that nakedness will be covered. The Lord couldn't use that as an expression for illicit sexual conduct if the norm weren't that nakedness would be covered. So there might be two separate sins in regard to that. If I uncover the nakedness of someone who is not my spouse, then that is wrong. But in the other direction, if I uncover my nakedness to someone who is not my spouse, then that is equally sinful. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 19, Solomon said, "Let your fountain be blessed. Rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love." This is one of many passages that talk about the exclusive nature of the marriage relationship. There are certain things that are to be enjoyed privately and exclusively by husbands and wives and nobody else outside that relationship. So he says to the young man, enjoy your wife's breasts, and that implies that the physical delights of her body are only for you. You don't satisfy yourself with anybody but her. But in the other direction, it also implies that she is not to give the physical satisfaction of her body to anybody except her husband. We're talking about an exclusive relationship here where there's some private enjoyments that don't belong to anybody outside of that relationship. It's simply true that men, compared to women, are more visually stimulated in regard to sexual matters. I say comparatively. It's not a strict difference, but compared to women, men are more aroused by visual stimuli. It doesn't take much more than a picture or a visual image for a man to be aroused sexually. Whereas for a woman, the relationship is much more important than the visual images. Now, that's not to say that visual images might not be a turn-on for a woman, but generally speaking, pornography is more of a temptation for men than for women, and that's why women's dress, their visual appearance, is so important. But not only are men more aroused by visual stimuli, they are more quickly aroused by any stimuli. Have you observed that? That, as somebody says, women are ovens, men are microwaves. You know, they heat up very quickly in comparison to women. So women, understand, if you don't understand this already, that it doesn't take much, even visually, to arouse a man's sexual interest in you. And if that man is not your husband, then there is a problem. Now, God made men the way they are, but He intended men to be aroused by the visual sight of their wives' bodies and no one else. And to allow that to take place outside the marriage relationship is wrong on several different levels, but I want to emphasize this morning that the main part of what's wrong about that is that it gives someone else that which they have no right to be enjoying, even visually, if they are not spouses. You're aware of the passage in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 14 where Peter talked about those who have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. It's an interesting expression, isn't it? Eyes full of adultery. I believe he's describing there a man who has a dirty mind. Here's a man who can't look at any woman without thinking unlawful sexual thoughts. His eyes are full of adultery. He can't get enough of the visual images of women. And nothing that we can do is going to prevent that man's lustful look. But listen, that's not the man that we're interested in this morning. We are concerned about the effect that dress has on the godly man who is trying his best not to be aroused by the sight of any woman other than his wife. Yes, there are men who can't look at any woman, no matter how she's dressed, without thinking sexual thoughts, but that's not the person we're talking about. This morning, we're thinking about what effect our dress might have on a godly man who really is trying to think pure thoughts. Sexually attractive dress produces sexual thoughts in any man's mind, even the most godly. And that's the man that we're primarily concerned about. Think with me for a little bit about the word attraction. What does it mean when you say that something attracts somebody else? You have that even in the realm of physics, don't you, where a magnet attracts filings of steel. Well, the word attract, our English word attract, comes from a compound Latin verb that meant to pull something in the direction of something else. It means to cause something to draw near, to pull toward. We've got other English words in that same family group. Attractor, it's a device that pulls. Traction means the physical ability to exert a pulling force. Well, apply that to the word attractive in regard to clothing. Literally, attractive means something that has an attractive power, that is a drawing or a pulling power. In its most general sense, if a lady said, "I just want to dress attractively," there wouldn't necessarily be anything wrong with that. If she means simply, "I want to dress in a way that's pleasing to the eye or the mind," charming would be a good synonym in that sense. But specifically, attractive clothing would be clothing that has the power to pull or draw attention in the direction of someone. Whether that's right or wrong depends upon several things. You know, attractive clothing pulls attention. The question is, what does it pull attention to? I'm a Southerner. I love moon pies, and I've got a moon pie T-shirt. And when I wear that, that obviously attracts attention to the fact that I like moon pies. I hope there's nothing wrong with that. But that's an example of attraction, that is, something about your appearance, draws somebody else's attention to something about you. Now, if it is sexual attention that you are drawing to yourself, that's a very serious matter if the man whose sexual attention you are drawing is not your husband. You're doing that by your visual appearance. If that's what you're pulling toward yourself and it's not your husband, then there is a serious problem. If you are married, you shouldn't want to get anybody but your husband into your tractor beam. Remember the Star Wars expression? And if you're not married, you shouldn't even use sex to attract a potential mate. Now, the man you catch with that kind of bait is a man you're going to be disappointed with long term. Instead, young women, unmarried young women, attract men with the thing about you that you want them to be the most interested in long term, and that is your character. Peter talks in 1 Peter 3 about the godly inward character of a woman, meek and quiet spirit and so forth. Don't worry, young women. Men will become sexually attracted to you on their own. You won't have to do anything to help that along. Song of Solomon, chapter 8 and verses 6 and 7, compares sexual attraction to a fire that almost can't be quenched. You want to keep that at bay as long as you can, because once it becomes inflamed, it's almost unquenchable. Before then, you want to draw attention to yourself and even do that in a modest way, but the thing about you that you want to pull young men toward as prospective mates is your character. So minimize sexual attraction if you're unmarried as long as possible. Put the emphasis on what you want a prospective mate to be most interested in. That is your character. But speaking of clothing that attracts, remember the expression in Proverbs chapter 7 and verse 10 where it says, there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. What would you say the attire of a harlot is? Well, many people have a misconception about that. The attire of a harlot wouldn't necessarily be clothing that says, I'm a harlot. It would be clothing that attracts sexual interest. That's what a harlot does. That's her business, to attract the sexual interest of men as potential customers. Now, that is not my definition. That is a definition that comes from an actual prostitute that I had the opportunity to talk to for several hours several years ago. May I quickly say, she was off duty. I was making a trip several years ago when I lived in Las Vegas, Nevada. I had to go one weekend up to Reno on business, and I just needed one-way transportation that weekend, so I decided to ride the bus. I hadn't ridden the bus in a while, so I'm waiting in the line to get up on the Greyhound bus, and there was a young couple standing in front of me waiting. I thought both of them would be getting on the bus, but when they got up to the door, they kissed goodbye. He left. She got on the bus. And so I was right behind her, so we ended up sitting together on the bus. And you know how it is in those situations. What do you do? Well, I work in the publishing business. What do you do? She said, well, in the week, I work in an office in Las Vegas, but on the weekends, I work up at Lida Junction. Well, I'd been between Las Vegas and Reno and through Lida Junction enough times to know that it was just one intersection with a flashing light there. On one corner, there was a gas station. On the other corner, there was a brothel. I said, you work in Lida Junction? She said, yes, I work in the brothel on weekends. And that had been her husband, by the way. They had kissed goodbye. She said, we need the extra income. And she said, many young women do this. It's not at all uncommon. You work through the week at another job, and you work in a brothel on weekends. And so we were going to have about an hour and a half or 2 hours ride together before she got off for her weekend job. And so I just plied her with some questions. I wanted to get her perspective on some things. And so I asked her about that phrase in Proverbs 7, verse 10, the attire of a harlot. I said, have you ever heard that phrase? She said, yes. I said, what would you say the attire of a harlot is? And she said, well, it wouldn't be the stereotype of the big hair and the gaudy makeup and everything that just shouts, you know, I'm a prostitute. She said, it would be attire that attracts potential customers. It draws sexual attention to yourself. In a brothel situation in Nevada, in the counties where prostitution is legal, you'd have a building and men who are potential customers would come in the front door into a lobby area, and there would be various girls there in the lobby. You didn't have a customer at the moment, and so you will pick which girl you wanted. So these girls work on commission, and so when a potential customer comes in, you've got to attract his attention sexually to you. So these are girls that have a vested business interest in knowing what attracts men's sexual attention and what doesn't. And so I was very curious to hear what she had to say about that. I said, you obviously have to know what works and what doesn't. How do you draw sexual attention to yourself, or particularly to certain parts of your body? And here's what she told me. She said there's several techniques. One is you could reveal the part of your body that you want to draw attention to. She said that's usually the least effective. She said total nudity is pretty repulsive with most people. She said, but if you totally reveal something, that might be provocative. But she said a better technique would be to conceal it and reveal everything else. That's the bikini effect, where the only parts of the body that are covered, you have extra attention drawn to those parts because they're the only parts that are covered. So she said you could do that. Or she said you could reveal just a little bit of it, a tantalizing preview. She said that's very powerful. Or she said you could cover it very tightly so that the form of it is clearly seen. Or she said you could cover it very thinly with fabric that's so thin or gauzy that it clearly suggests what is underneath. Well, I found that to be an interesting list. I'm a woman who has a business interest in knowing how you pull or draw sexual attention to yourself or to a particular part of your body. You reveal it. You conceal it and reveal everything else. You reveal just a little bit of it. You cover it tightly or you cover it thinly. We're going to come back to this list in a little bit. But think about that for just a moment. When someone says, well, maybe what I wear is sexually attractive in one of those areas or another, but that's not the reason I'm doing it. I'm just wearing that clothing because it's attractive, or it's what in style, or it's cute, or my boyfriend likes it, or whatever. Well, listen, as far as men are concerned, sexually attractive clothing always works. It works almost every time. That is, it sexually attracts the men who see you, whether that was your intent or not. And it has that effect not just on men with dirty minds, but on every man who sees you, if he's a normal red-blooded man, including the ones who are trying their best to think godly thoughts. Do you understand that our clothing sends signals? Just like almost everything else we do sends signals. Some of the signals that we send are verbal, others are nonverbal. Almost all day, every day, we're sending signals that other people are receiving. And clothing happens to be a big part of the way that we send signals. Clothing is used socially in many ways to send all kind of nonverbal communications. By our clothing, we may be sending sexual signals that we don't intend and maybe that we are not even aware of. But the signals are sent anyway. Several years ago, an older preacher who's a good friend of mine worked in Norway with his wife for a couple of years in the Lord's work. And they said after they moved to Norway, they noticed that the Norwegian women didn't have much to do with his wife. And they finally found out why. She came to Norway doing what many American women do. She wore earrings occasionally. In Norway, only prostitutes wear earrings. In Norway, that sends a signal that it doesn't send in the United States. Well, what do you think she did when they found out about that? She put her earrings away. She didn't wear them anymore in Norway because even it wouldn't be enough for her to say, well, you know, that's not why I'm wearing them. I've got a right to wear what I want to. It doesn't matter how anybody receives that. No, if you're sending signals, even that you're not aware you're sending, it has the effect whether you intend that signal to be sent or not, if that's what that is in that culture. We are responsible, folks, for the signals that we send to those around us. And if we're not sure what signals we're sending, we need to ask somebody that can tell us for objective advice about that. It's naive to think that nobody's receiving any signals except those that you intend to be sending. It's a little bit more complicated than that. One of the signals that we send with our clothing is this. Your clothing will identify you with a certain segment of society. Which segment of society do you want to be identified with? Godly people? Cool people? People who are culturally with it? Popular people? Who do you want to be identified with? When we're in school, we strongly want to be identified with the popular people, don't we? So we would like, by our dress, to send signals that we're a part of that crowd. And many times we want to dress so that people will get that signal and conclude that that's the segment of society that we're a part of. Well, I'll tell you, it's not always an either-or choice, but if it came to a choice, wouldn't we want, if we had to sacrifice personal taste in order to be identified with God's people? Several years ago when I was a younger preacher, I had somebody said, "Gary, you dress like a gospel preacher." I used to resent that. Somehow I wanted to be a gospel preacher, but I didn't want people to see that I was. Well, I don't resent that anymore. I'm rather okay with somebody seeing me and thinking, "Well, you're a gospel preacher." What's wrong with being identified with God's people? I'll tell you. It's not true, but if God's people in our generation were known for wearing some ugly, repulsive color of green all the time, I'd wear that color of green all the time, even if I didn't like it. If that's who that identified me with, then I need to be okay being identified with the Lord's people. So what kind of signals are you sending with the clothing that you wear? Sometimes I'm afraid we're inconsistent. We send sexual signals, we wear sexually attractive clothing, and then we act like we're offended when somebody responds to that. That's inconsistent. A couple of years ago, I was in a bank in Nashville. I had to go inside to the lobby, and this gal at the teller window was waiting on me, and I'm telling you, she had such a low-cut blouse. I was really fearful of what was going to happen if she bent over too far. But it was impossible for me, separated from her by only about 2 feet. I tried, as a man, not to look at her cleavage, but it was impossible, virtually impossible. I was trying, but I was failing. And she said, "You got a problem with my breasts?" And I said, "Well, ma'am," I said, "you've got them on public display. I'm trying not to look, but I have to look somewhat in your direction. You're making it nearly impossible for me not to look. Why would you dress that way and then act offended if somebody does what is natural about that? How can you wear clothing that is clearly sexually attractive and then be offended when somebody's attracted by that?" I think probably what she would have said is, "Well, Mr. Henry, I would like for some guys to be attracted by that, but not an old fogey like you." Well, signals are signals. If you publicly advertise, then the public has a right to respond. You can't try to attract only a certain segment of the population. It works with all men, regardless of whether that's your intent or not. You wear sexually attractive clothing, you may as well hang a sign in the front of you that says, "I'm open for business." Because that's what that signal says. And it's inconsistent to send those signals and then say, "But I'm only open for business with certain people." Fact is, nobody but your husband, if you're married, has a right to be seeing that, regardless of the effect or not. So let's go back to our list. How would you draw attention to a certain part of your body sexually? Remember the prostitute's list? Well, you might reveal it. I'll tell you, I know skin is in, particularly in the warmer months. But it is still true, ladies, that the more skin an outfit reveals, the more sexually attractive it is to a man. Just no way around that. And there are outfits in the room this morning that reveal too much skin. It'd be impossible for me as a normal man to look at the exposure of that percentage of your skin on your body and not be pulled in your direction sexually. Well, she said you might conceal it and reveal everything else. So that's, she called it the bikini effect. And that's exactly what it is. Swimsuits, especially two-piece swimsuits, only reveal certain parts, you know, the most sexual parts of the body, but by doing so, draw attention to those very parts. That's the intent. Sports Illustrated has not yet run a nude woman or even a topless woman on the front cover of its famous swimsuit issue in February every year. But they don't need to. The models on the front page of their swimsuit issue have only the very most sexual parts of their bodies covered, and thereby that's exactly what any man's attention is drawn to who sees those pictures. Much more tantalizing than if they were uncovered. You cover it and conceal everything else. Or she said you could reveal just a little bit of it. Here's the tantalizing preview. Gals, speaking as a man, if your skirt is short enough to give me even a glimpse of your thigh, if you give me a preview of the upper part of your leg, even if it's just a slight preview, I'm going to be sexually interested in you. I'll be sexually attracted to you with that just a little bit view. Jeans that give a peekaboo of the lower back, and almost all of them do now, don't they? From a man's vantage point, that little preview is very tantalizing. Almost impossible to not be attracted by that. And what about cleavage? Ladies, for anybody but your husband, any cleavage is too much. Now, I know we're in the South, where even in antebellum days, the display of cleavage was very fashionable, particularly with formal gowns and such. But the effect of that on a man is obvious. And I repeat, any cleavage is too much for anybody other than your husband. Bare midriffs, that once again don't reveal the whole body, but they give a tantalizing preview of that which a man would like to see more of. If he's not your husband, he has no right to see that or even to be tantalized by a preview of it. Let me say a word to those of you, our ladies, who are shorter in stature. If you dress and you stand in front of a mirror and check out whether the view of you is sexually attractive or not, may I suggest that you do not see in that view what I see if I'm taller than you and I'm in a conversation where I'm looking down on you. What you see straight on may be perfectly acceptable. But I see a good bit more of you when I look down from a slightly higher perspective. So women, checking whether there's any cleavage or not, don't just look straight on in the mirror. Try to anticipate what a man would see if you bend over or if he is taller than you. That tantalizing preview is sexually attractive, and it's wrong for you to be attracting the sexual interest of anybody who's not your husband. And she said you could cover it tightly. Here we'd have to talk about so-called modest swimsuits, wouldn't we? It's hard for me to imagine how any kind of a modern swimsuit would be modest in any of these categories. But even the ones that some of us think are relatively more modest, what they don't reveal, they cover so tightly that absolutely nothing is left to the imagination. This prostitute said, if you want to draw sexual attention to a certain part of your body, cover it tightly. I was in a barbecue restaurant not too long ago, and there was a gal working in the restaurant that day. She was very, very attractive, and she was dressed in what I judged to be an interesting way. It was a rather warm day, but she had on a long sleeve top and blue jeans. There was virtually no, as far as revealing skin, the only part of her skin that you could see was her hands and from her neck up. But every item of clothing that she had on was so tight that it didn't require me to exercise a very great leap of imagination to imagine what she looked like nude. She may as well have been nude just because her clothing was so tight. What can we say about the style of jeans right now? And it's not in style to wear baggy jeans, is it? At least for girls. Girls, we got a problem. And maybe what's in style, and maybe what you think you're going to have to wear to be accepted at school or among the people that you want to be popular with. But gals, jeans that tight, from a male perspective, are extremely attractive sexually. Not just to men with dirty minds, not just to the man whose eyes are full of adultery, but to any man. But regardless of response, you don't have any right demonstrating the form of your body, however tightly it may be covered, to anybody who is not your husband. Tops that are so tight that they clearly reveal the shape of your breasts. The more ample a woman's bosom is, the more loose-fitting her top needs to be. Tight-fitting tops that they may cover everything. There's no skin revealed, but if it's tight enough that it clearly reveals the shape of your breasts, then men can't help but notice that in an attractive way. Or cover it thinly. It's almost impossible for white tops to be modest, aren't they, ladies? Because they very often reveal your undergarments. Tops that are thin enough to reveal parts of your upper anatomy that are very tantalizing to a man who views that. Pants thin enough that we can clearly see the outline of your underwear. Know about the thong that you've got on because we see it clearly outlined because your pants are thin enough to reveal that. Do you see how in every one of these categories, and this, again, is not my list, this is not an old fogey preacher talking, this is a prostitute who has a business interest in knowing what works and what doesn't, in every one of these areas, we've got clothing in the building this morning that by this prostitute's definition are sexually attractive. We need not deny it. And it doesn't do any good to say, well, that's not my intent. Signals are sent nonetheless. And we are so, as I said in the beginning, such captives of our culture that sometimes we really don't see it. We don't see the extent to which we, like our next door neighbors, have begun dressing in ways that attract the sexual attention of men whose sexual attention we don't have any business attracting if we're not married to them. If you dress in any kind of these ways, ladies, I see you and I think lustful thoughts, I've got a problem. I'm responsible for that. I may lose my soul because of doing something that I could have chosen to try not to do, but you've got a problem as well. We both got a problem. If you're sending signals that attract my sexual interest, then you've got a problem, I've got a problem, we've got a problem. When you wear these kinds of clothing, you are initiating a sexual transaction. If it never goes beyond my thoughts that are responding to your initiation, that's still a bad transaction if I'm not your husband. Biblically, those who initiate a transaction in which sin takes place have the greater blame. Remember Balaam, who taught the people of Israel, or taught the people of Midian, to put a stumbling block before the people of Israel so that the men of Israel came and committed fornication with the Midianite women and then worshiped their idols. Everybody in that story committed sin, but Balaam is condemned for having suggested that. He set that train of events in action, and he bore the greater blame because he was the initiator. Jezebel, in 1 Kings 21, is said to have enticed her husband Ahab to commit idolatry. Well, he's responsible for his part of the sin, but she has the greater blame because she stirred him up to do that. She initiated it. Jeroboam, in 1 Kings 14, verse 16, was said to have caused the people of Israel to commit idolatry. What's that? He built those idols. He initiated the transaction, and they followed suit. Everybody committed sin, but he had the greater blame because he initiated it. What about the Jews and Pilate? Now, who put Jesus to death? You wanted to assign the primary responsibility. A lot of people committed mistakes in that complicated scenario. But what did Jesus say in John 19, verse 11 to Pilate? He said, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it has been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." That mean Pilate didn't commit sin in what he did, but he said those who initiated this chain of events have the greater blame. Peter's hypocrisy in Galatians chapter 2. The passage says he Even Barnabas was carried away with that hypocrisy. Well, who had the greater blame? Peter did, because he influenced Barnabas in that direction. So the application to sexually attractive clothing ought to be clear. And I'll just tell you, ladies, we live in dangerous days in regard to sexual crime. It's by your clothing you initiate a sexual transaction, you may get more transaction than you bargained for. You'd be lucky if all some other man did was to see you and think sexual thoughts, but many times in our culture it's going to go beyond that. The subject of date rape is a huge problem in our society. I sat next to a lawyer from California years ago when I was flying back from California to where I was living in Indianapolis at the time, and he had the look, you know, of the California lawyer. He had long gray hair and a ponytail, and he was in a business suit. And so I said, what kind of case are you coming back to try? And he said, it's a date rape case. His client was the young lady. She had been raped on a date, so the allegation was, by her boyfriend at the time at a frat party. He admitted that they were both drunk, but he had gone farther with their sexual transaction that night than she wanted to, and so she later said, he raped me. Well, just to see what his response would be, I said, what was she wearing that night? Well, I thought he was going to come unglued at the very suggestion of that question. That doesn't have any bearing on the case, he said. Well, maybe not from a legal standpoint. But if by her clothing she was sending sexual signals, she was saying, come on, I'm open for business, and she got more than she bargained for, though if he raped her, he's certainly guilty of rape and he needs to be prosecuted accordingly, she might could have avoided that by not initiating a sexual transaction by sending the signals that she did. Now, he may have raped her anyway. No, nobody will ever know. But ladies, in our culture, I'm saying this is more than just a subject of idle curiosity. You need to be careful in this culture, before you wear things that attract people's sexual interest to you that you may not wish you had attracted their sexual interest. If you're going to initiate something, Paul talks in Titus 2, verse 10, about adorning the doctrine of God. Why can't we, if we're going to initiate some thoughts, let's initiate some good thoughts. Dress in such a way that the thoughts that are initiated are good rather than evil. Well, the heart is certainly the heart of this matter, isn't it? The fundamental importance of the heart can't be overestimated. Luke 6, verse 45, Jesus said, the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good. The evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. It's our inner character that produces our speech, our behavior, and our external conduct, including our clothing. And it is true that modesty is first and foremost a character trait. So we need to make sure that our hearts are pure and chaste, that they truly respect God. But we can't just stop working on the heart. We also need to make sure that our outward conduct is consistent with a godly and a pure heart. We need to watch out for disconnections between our heart and our outward conduct. We may be dressing immodestly and truly not be able to see it. We may have just been so programmed by what's in style that we don't see how sexually attractive this is to a man. It may be in our blind spot, so to speak. And if we can't see it, we may need the help of a more objective observer, such as a husband, a father, an elder in the local congregation, an older friend, somebody who will tell you what kind of signals you're sending by the clothing that you are wearing. Quickly, let's talk about some of the objections that we sometimes hear to lessons like this. Number one is that people will very often say, well, you know, Brother Henry, this is a matter of the heart. Externals don't matter. I have a pure heart, and so it doesn't matter how I dress. What matters is the heart. Well, that's true that the heart does matter, but externals also matter. Wives, suppose the next time your birthday comes around, or your anniversary, or Valentine's Day, and you don't get a gift, you don't get a card, you don't get any gesture of love from your husband or your boyfriend, and you ask about that, and he says, well, honey, Love is a matter of the heart. Externals don't matter. You'd say, yeah, right. We understand, don't we, that the character is the most important thing, but externals need to show up that are consistent with what we say is going on in our heart. And so if we have a modest heart, that's fine, but let's make sure that our dress is consistent with that. Somebody else says, well, it's hard to find modest clothes, and I know that's true. If you're not a seamstress and you can't make your own clothes, you may have a hard time finding clothes that are modest to buy. But when was difficulty ever an excuse for not doing what's right? Seems to me I remember the Lord said it would be difficult. Narrow is the gate and difficult is the way that leads to salvation. What were we expecting except difficulty? Or modest clothes are outdated. They're ugly. They're not cute. I just don't like them. Well, I think that's a false dilemma between modesty and style. Some of the most modest women I know dress very stylishly and attractive in the general sense of just being charming and pleasing. So I don't think you have to make a choice between style and modesty. But even if you did, the choice would be clear, wouldn't it? If you had to choose between modesty and style, wouldn't you choose modesty? Your choice that you make when it comes to radical choices like that will say a whole lot about what your real priorities are. Well, it's men who have the problem, somebody says. They should control their thoughts. Men should control their thoughts. If a man thinks illicit thoughts about you, that's sin, and he bears responsibility for it. No excuse for that. But the point we've made is nobody except your husband has a right to see certain things, regardless of what the response may or may not be. Talking about a privacy issue here of what's exclusive property to you and your husband. Somebody else says, style change. Your modesty is culturally determined. You know, what's modest today or what may have been immodest years ago is not immodest anymore because styles have changed. Well, styles do change, and to a certain limited extent, modesty is culturally determined. But I'll tell you what it takes to arouse a man's sexual interest in you has not changed since Adam. And it's not going to change. Yes, styles change, but men don't. And what's sexually attractive has not changed, and that's what you've got to factor into your thinking, regardless of what is in style or not. Somebody else says it's a matter of judgment. I never have spoken on this subject, I don't think, but what somebody said, well, where do you draw the line? It's a matter of judgment. Well, it does involve the exercise of judgment, but with sexual modesty, the line's not hard to draw. It's a matter of whether something is sexually attractive to men who would see you. If you have a hard time drawing that line, just ask a man. They will tell you in a heartbeat whether that's sexually attractive or not, if they're honest with you. Well, yes, but there are exceptional situations, somebody says. And I don't have time. I'm already way over time tonight. I'm going to try to wrap this up as quickly as I can, but don't get me started on weddings, banquets, cheerleading, dance teams, the prom. It's hard for me to imagine what business a Christian young man or woman has going to the prom in the first place. Nothing about that that a Christian would need to be involved in. But with regard to our subject today, would that be an exceptional situation where you dress modestly all the rest of the time, but you wouldn't if it's some kind of a formal event? Swimming, the only modest swimsuits I've ever seen were from about 200 years ago. All the ones today are immodest. With all of these so-called exceptional situations, sports, we'll dress immodestly when we wouldn't otherwise if it's an athletic event. I tell you, it's almost impossible to watch the Olympics now, isn't it? Winter or summer. What is going on here? We think, well, here are the rules of modesty, and I will respect those most of the time, but here's an exceptional situation, or here's another exceptional situation, as if the rules don't apply in these exceptional situations. Well, why don't they? By what rule of logic could we say that those are exceptional? I won't agree to do a wedding service anymore without seeing pictures of what the young lady's going to be wearing before I agree to do it. And it's just, it's unimaginable. The exception that some otherwise very godly young women will make when it comes to their wedding gown and the gowns of their bridesmaids. The preacher can't anymore preach the service without trying to position his Bible between himself and the bride's bosom. What are we thinking? If there's an occasion in your life where you would want to be overly modest or chaste, wouldn't that be it? The public doesn't have a right to be seeing that. At your wedding, nobody will have a right to see that but your husband, and he won't get to see it for a few more hours yet. What are we thinking about? Well, I just want to fit in. I just want to be accepted. We all do. The person who says they don't care what anybody thinks, that person probably lie about other things too. We all care about what other people think. But would we sell our souls for the approval of others? Would we be like Peter, who denied his Lord just so he wouldn't stick out and be different in that group around the enemy's fire that night when the Lord was being tried? Would we sell even our Lord simply to not be thought of as odd or different? Or some more aggressive people would say, it's nobody's business what I wear except my own. Well, the Christian just doesn't have the luxury of saying it's nobody's business what I do except mine. We wear the Lord's name. People draw conclusions about the Lord based upon what they see us doing or saying if they know that we are the Lord's people. We've got to do that not only which is honorable in the Lord's sight. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8:21, we've got to give some regard to what's generally known to be honorable even in the sight of the public if we wear the Lord's name. And then finally, a lot of ladies will say, well, that's a good lesson, Brother Henry, but it just doesn't apply to me. Well, it might apply to you and you just not be able to see it. Ask a godly man who'll be both objective and honest with you. I must tell you that I have been very gratified. And I have never preached this lesson, even at home, except I was asked to preach it. It was preached about 3.5 years ago at Broadmoor at the request of our elders, and I've been requested to present it 3 other times. This is the fourth other time that I've ever been asked to speak on this. So I don't go around just preaching this to audiences that haven't asked for it. But I must tell you, every time I've presented this lesson, it has been extremely gratifying to me to see what the response is. I've been touched by the number of ladies, not just young women, but mothers and grandmothers even, who have come to me and very honestly and transparently said, right on. It's exactly right. If you ever see me wearing something that's not modest and I can't see it, would you please point it out so that I can make the necessary correction? Well, you can't ask for a better response than that. That's exactly the way we all ought to have any response to any lesson. To want help seeing things that we may not be able to see because they're in our blind spot. The willingness to be warned that we talked about in our lesson this morning. I want to close by suggesting, first of all, some thoughts about male leadership. Some advice to our men. Men, you first of all need to think and dress modestly yourself. It won't do you any good to try to work with your wife or your daughters on this subject if you yourself do not think and dress modestly yourself. Don't watch immodest entertainment, wherever it may be, on television, or wherever. Don't watch it if it's immodest. Do what Job talked about in Job 31, verse 1. Make a covenant with your eyes, an agreement. Here are some things I will not look at. My eyes will be on orders. I'll have made a covenant with them not to look at certain things. I know a man who made a covenant with his eyes never to look below a woman's chin. That'd be a hard covenant to keep, wouldn't it? But I appreciate the integrity of a man who says, if that's what it takes, if immodesty is such a problem that you can't any longer look below a woman's chin, then that's what I'm going to do. I appreciate him for that. Teach your wives and your daughters, and your sons too, Your wife and your daughters need to hear the honest truth about modesty from a man. When I asked this prostitute why, when she told me how all of this works in her business realm, I said, I don't believe many of my religious sisters understand that. And I said, do religious women just not know how this works? And you know what she said? She said, well, I expect most of them know more about how it works than they let on like. But she said, probably some of them don't know how it works. And I said, why do you think that is? And she said, because many religious women only know about sex what they've been taught by their mothers, by their same-sex parent. And she said, if a woman has never been taught by anybody but a woman how a man's mind works, she probably doesn't understand how a man's mind works. Fathers, your wife and your daughters need to hear from you on this subject, how this works. That's where they'll learn how a man's mind works. As the head of your household, you are responsible for enforcing the rules of modesty in your home. If your wife or your daughters are here this morning and dressed immodestly, the buck stops on your desk. How did they go out of your house with your permission this morning? Exercise some leadership. You may meet some resistance, but you've got a responsibility. Nobody ever said leadership would be easy. And my sisters, we've talked about the exclusive private property of the marriage relationship. Save yourselves for your husbands. Don't even give tantalizing previews of the delights of your body to anybody in public. Nobody but your husbands have the right to that joyous private pleasure garden. Save yourself for your Lord. Be His alone. Don't prostitute yourself in a generic sense by giving yourself to the world. Save yourself for your Lord and save yourself for heaven. Don't lose your soul for the popularity or the attractiveness that you think you've got to have in this world. I don't care what it is. It's not worth losing your soul over. So save yourselves for heaven. It's not true that modesty can never be stylish. But even if it were true, the Christian's choice would be clear. Do we only do the Lord's will when it costs us nothing, when there's no sacrifice to be made? Surely we're prepared to give the Lord more than that. Can we not spell the word sacrifice? Here's something I would love to wear. Maybe it's something that costs me a lot of money. I already own it. But it's not modest. And I'll sacrifice what I want in order to pursue a higher priority. Well, you've listened very courteously to a lesson that has been difficult to present this morning. Listen, I offer these thoughts to you with all humility. I'm not a perfect person. You're going to find that out if you didn't know it already. You're going to find it out before this week is over. I am full of my own faults and failings. But I do believe a warning needs to be sounded on this particular subject. And I appreciate your elders for asking that this warning be sounded. I may be old, and I may be just a preacher, but I've been around the block a time or two. And to my shame, I'll have to admit that I know more about how all this works than I should know. I've tried to shoot straight with you this morning. What I've said to you would be confirmed by any man in this room who's willing to be honest about life in the real world. All of us have blind spots. It's hard for us to see ourselves objectively. James says, James 3, verse 2, we all stumble in many ways. So in the real world, our salvation depends on our willingness to be warned. We'll be like those in Hezekiah's day. 2 Chronicles 30, verse 6, it says, the couriers went throughout all Israel and Judah with letters from the king and his princes, as the king had commanded, saying, O people of Israel, return to the Lord. Return to the Lord. But they laughed them to scorn and mocked them. Let's don't be listeners like that. Let's be like Paul, willing to count all things loss that we may gain Christ. And I really believe lessons like this present a a test for us, don't they? They test us and make us face a choice. Are we going to take steps even further away from God? Or are we going to take steps toward God? Even if it's just a little step, a little adjustment that you could make about this subject this morning, whether you're a man or you're a woman, if anybody would take any step, make any adjustment at all, then it would be worthwhile for us to have spent this time talking about it. Thank you for listening. You're here this morning and we can assist you in obeying the Lord in any kind of public way. And that would be our desire to want to help you and encourage you. We sing this song to provoke you to think about your spiritual relationship to the Lord. We can assist you in taking some step in His direction. We'd love to do so. Won't you come while we stand and sing the invitation song?